want to welcome you to another episode of Passports, Please. Conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. And today, we are just already enjoying a conversation with a good friend of Rodney's and my. I'm your co-host, Chick Morgan, the Cowgirl Diva, along with my co-host,
Rodney Burzeal,
the photographer-in-chief. And we are very lucky to consider Susan Gibson not only a friend, but a neighbor in Wimberley. Not that it's done many of us any good for the last year. Yeah. Next time we have you, Susan, we will have you in studio again.
I'm so looking forward to, you know, getting together, but I'm so proud of us for finding a way around it. You know, I just think that's, we're water, man. We'll just flow around.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's great.
And I've been reading a little bit, and actually through that experiencing, what I'm starting to read a little bit about is, as much as we've all wanted at least some return to the physical presence and the hugs, there's still a little, at least on my part, a little anxiety about kind of re-entering this world again and being very careful about where my time goes. And even getting my COVID shot the other day, sitting in the First Baptist Church with, must have been, I don't know, 150 people, I looked around, I thought, I haven't been in a room with this many people in over a year, and it felt strange.
Yeah, what's that going to be like when we go back to concerts and you're shoulder to shoulder with all these people again? It's, you know, that's going to be on your mind still.
This has kind of been one of those things that has fundamentally changed me as a person, and things I so took for granted, good and bad, that were always there. You know, I've been trying to look at it as an opportunity to kind of do a little discernment on what I'm going to be doing. You know what, Chick, I completely feel that same. I feel a sense of anxiety. I feel like I don't remember how my music career started.
Oh,
so it's like,
that's too bad, because that was one of our questions.
this is the deal.
All right, thanks.
I scratch that off the list, Rodney.
Yeah, but no, I can tell you a good story. But,
all right, well, we'll let you finish this particular thought.
Well, you know, it is. I can't think of how to get started.
Oh,
like I'm thinking, you know, yeah, there was a time when I didn't have gigs, and then I did have gigs.
Yeah,
But it's really tough to get started. So, you know, where I feel lucky now is that I have, you know, 25 years of a career where I'm getting some phone calls about playing some gigs, because I cannot for the life of me remember how to cold call somebody and ask for a gig.
Well, so, and let's start with that, because at least 25 years, you have been a full-time singer, songwriter, traveling troubadour. You mentioned your van a few minutes ago and the dogs. I mean, you know, I've loved you and been friends with you and certainly followed you on your adventures for years, but for a while, your van was part of that story.
And for sure.
Becoming aware of just how important the supporting structures are to that kind of life. But you you left the big wilds of the North, and were you in a van at that point? Is that when your dad yelled, check the oil? And
no. Oh, no, I was in a, what year was it? I think it was a 1988 Oldsmobile Cutlass Sierra.
I think everybody had one of those at some point.
Yeah.
That's the car you have to pass through in order to get other cars.
Yeah. Wow.
No, it was my first car was a 69 Pontiac Catalina, and it was my grandmother's car on my dad's side, and when she passed away, that was the car that I learned to drive on. I mean, it is about 30 feet long.
Yeah.
So that's what I learned to parallel park. You know?
That's without the pontoons, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It could fit four spare tires in the trunk of that car. Like my dad, I could have completely rebuilt that car from the ground up if I'd had a problem. You know, that car was huge.
Yeah, so you can stick a mattress back there and just tour in that.
Yeah. We had 11 people in that car one time.
Oh,
and check this out. Everyone could fit in a seatbelt. They weren't the retractable extendable. They just came all the way out and would go over.
Yeah, they just laid there.
Yeah.
A lot of good they did us.
Yeah. But my car that I had when Dad Gale checked the oil was my grandmother on my mother's side of the car. So my first two cars were purchased from the estates of my grandmother's. And that's what I took up to school in Montana. And then that's what I drove back home when I started to nanny for my sister, which is what got me back from Montana down to Texas. And then when I was back in Amarillo, which is where I'd grown up and gone to school, that's when I started singing with a band and kind of realizing, you know, that realization that I probably am not going to go finish college. I'm going to do this instead. So.
Was that the Groobies band in Amarillo?
Yeah. Yep, that was.
Was that a misspelling? Was it supposed to be Groovies and somebody?
what a good question. Or Groupies?
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been so many things that went wrong. But the Groovy was a character on Gumby and Pokey. There was a little
How did I miss that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
He was only in a few episodes.
Oh, that would explain it. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those deep cuts of Gumby and Pokey.
Yeah.
So how did the Groobies come about as a band?
Well, they were an existing band when I got to them. So the other songwriter, so there were a couple of local bands around Amarillo, and like a lot of the guys would play in two different bands. So there was a band called the Blue Johnnies. I'll give you the genealogy of Amarillo.
I love that.
Kata. There was a band called the Blue Johnnies, and they were they did original stuff, which was kind of unusual for that area. I mean, I'm sure there were a lot of people, you know, writing songs and doing that thing. They were kind of the heart of the music scene. They were really popular with the Amarillo College had its own radio station, and you know, they traveled throughout Texas and had really great followings. And anyway. They were kind of the band in town, according to on my radar, you know. And this was when I was in high school and maybe a couple years after high school. So one of the guys in that band was writing his own songs, but they weren't really appropriate for what the Blue Johnnies were doing. And so Scott Malott started another band with a couple of his buddies, and that was the Groobies. And how I got introduced to them was a guitar player named Gary Thomason, that he and I, before I moved up to Montana to go to school, so this would have been about like 90, 91, he and I had kind of an acoustic folk duo, and we were playing all, you know, the Lilith Fair Ladies songs. You know, I was just learning to play guitar, and so we were playing, you know, Tracy Chapman, Sean Colvin, Mary Chapin Carpenter, Indigo Girls, Suzanne Vega, 10,000 Maniacs, you know, just all the women. Because when I first started playing and singing, man, I really did just listen to women because I was trying to sound like that. And I didn't see myself sounding like the Rolling Stones. So I wasn't learning those songs. I was learning these ones that I thought I could kind of emulate a little bit better. And then, Gary was my introduction to the Groobies. So they had already had an album out that I actually came down one Christmas and sang backing vocals on. And it was going to be backing vocals on one song, and it ended up being backing vocals on 9 songs. And so then when I decided I was going to leave school in Montana and come down kind of for good, then they let me into the band, and I was writing a little bit then. I probably had, you know, a dozen songs or so, maybe 20. I think I had songs which were any good, you know, at all. And when you put something with the band, man, that gives you that so gave energy to songs that I didn't think had energy.
Oh, yeah.
Them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was really, it was fun. We had a good time, and we made 4 records. We were together from like 96 through about 2001, I think.
What was the first song that you wrote and maybe recorded that you considered good and can remember today?
All of them.
Well, of course. That's us. We remember all of them. But
you know what? I liked the first song I ever wrote, but I never recorded it. Hmm. But there was a song that the first song of mine that I ever wrote and heard recorded, like in a studio, not just on my jam box, was a song called In My Garden. And it was, we did it with a band, and it was on like a Amarillo College radio sampler, but we never put it on a record. But it was that, it was that realization that, you know, being greater than the sum of your parts, kind of thing, of that feeling of, you know, this song that I liked, it became this different thing that I, you know, it was still recognizable to me, but it was just this realization of the potential of stuff where you think, oh, I didn't really connect to it as much then as I do now. Hmm. Like there was just some energy. And, you know, we were very young, and it was, I think some of that glow on that song was just, they played it on the radio. They played it on the Amarillo College radio, which was a huge deal.
Yeah.
You know, like that was my first big deal of like being like, whoa, that feels great.
That's me. That's me.
Yeah. So,
So you were very involved in the music, writing music, recording CDs. And then there were a couple of pretty interesting intersections in your life that took you to a whole nother dimension. Tell us a little bit about that, because it involves a lot of our friends and neighbors.
Tell me what you're talking about, because I've had many, many cool intersections.
Well, why don't you start with
let's
one?
Hear them all.
And I'll if you don't get to mine, I'll prompt you.
Okay, good. Well, you know, the one that I'm thinking about is while I was in the Groovy a long time ago, but Malat, the other writer and kind of the founder of that band, and Mike Devers, who was our bass player and kind of our manager, we really started touring a lot. When we were getting ready to make the second record, which would have been the first one that I was in from the beginning. And they hounded Lloyd Maines to produce an album for us. And I wasn't really quite sure of Lloyd. And I didn't know him because my head wasn't in that music scene. I was listening to the folk women of, you know, Berkeley. And so through connecting with Lloyd, he made a record with us and heard a song that I wrote called Wide Open Spaces. And that kind of went right into where his daughter Natalie was just joining this pre-existing band as well called the Dixie Chicks. And so they grabbed that song and they took it around the solar system. And that was really a landmark for me. That was, you know, that was my second, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah.
Playing music is easy and fun.
Yeah.
And it always works out.
It can happen to anyone.
Yeah, totally.
Who doesn't know what I'm talking about? Who's never left home? Who's never struck out to find a dream and a life of their own? A place in the clouds, a foundation of stone. Many precede and many will follow. A young girl's dream no longer hollow. It takes the shape of a place out west. But what it holds for her, she hasn't yet guessed. She needs wide open spaces, room to make her big mistakes. She needs new faces. She knows the high stakes.
And then there were some pretty hard lessons that went along with that about the business and, you know, my ability or inability to ask for help or, just learned a ton about myself. About, I was just kind of this scared, small person that thought other people were going to look out for
me. Would you mind sharing a story about that or example of that?
Yeah, well, I think what it is I just never had a career plan. I just said, okay, I'll try it. Two opportunities. It was, you know, really worked out well.
Yeah, but there plans are overrated. So.
Yeah, well, and plans lead to expectations,
exactly.
Which are devastating. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to resentments. So there, you know, there's the trouble right there. But you know, Chick, I think instead of just one particular story, I think the overarching lesson for was, you know, I was running around. It was a blast. And I was, you know, I was enjoying all of the things that you think about when you're touring with the band, and the, you know, drinking too much. And, you know, I just wasn't paying attention. I was not paying attention to what was going on. And so when our band broke up, which, you know, it wasn't terrible. It was heartbreaking because it was as close to a marriage as I've ever had, you know, of being kind of committed in a committed relationship with people and having these babies, these song babies that we've together and these album babies, you know, that's as close as I've gotten, which is kind of sad. That's kind of sad in itself, but we don't have to talk about
not
that
really.
Right now.
That's another podcast. Yeah. That's next week.
When's your therapy podcast? I want to get on the
about
therapy.
About 5 minutes after this one's over.
Yeah.
And you and Ronnie and I rotate, by the way, isn't
it? But, you know, when that band broke up, and we had some good momentum going, you know, as industry-wise. We had had this success with the song, and our name was getting out there, and the gigs were getting better. And so when that kind of came to a halt, I really did feel like someone let me out on the 10th floor, and I did not know how. I had been carried up the stairs the whole way. You know what I mean? And I did not know how to proceed because I wasn't paying attention. And I was letting other people handle everything, which I have, you know, I have chapter two of that same story of, you know, thinking, okay, this person is going to help me. And now I can take my hands off of it and I can go do whatever I want to do because I'm the person handling it. Well, that doesn't work in a creative business or in a self-employed situation. Mm-hmm. Like, right. Like nobody should care more about what you're doing than you do. And that, you know, I've had to learn that lesson a couple times, but I'm ashamed to say that I don't learn it the first time. Cause that, you know, the way I got through the Groobies thing was to say, okay, that was hard. And that was, but I never have to learn that lesson again. And then here, then I find myself in a situation where I'm depending on someone else to get better care of my business than I am, because I want to just do the fun parts. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot to this business that is not what I consider my skill set to be. Mm-hmm. But I get help, and it's wonderful help. But inevitably, I, you know, kind of crush that partnership with, you know, placing too much responsibility on them. And then again, you know, plans, expectations, resentment. So, you know, that's been a kind of a little bit of a theme when I look inside my arc of a career, you know, that the other side of that is I've gotten to work with some really good people and still have good relationships with them. It's just, you know, I've had to kind of come to terms with what other people, what the line of responsibility, boundaries. I have a problem with that.
Well,
there it is.
Yeah. You're talking to two other entrepreneur creatives here.
Yeah.
And I certainly relate to what you're saying. And Rodney, middle of opening a gallery and his career getting ready to explode. And I am just resonating with every single word. The fun part is the part that it's birthed inside of us and it comes out and there's nothing that can stop it. But then there are all of this paperwork that has to be done. And I'm doing air quotes with paperwork, and it really does go against the grain of why we do what we do, but it has to become a part of what we do.
Isn't it Terry Hendricks that says, the part that ain't art?
Yeah, for sure, man.
Which on some days seems like most of it. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
But here you are after this, in the middle of this really extraordinary career. And one of the things I love about talking to you, and I've always always loved about talking to you as, you know, a girlfriend, but also learning so much from you about the art and the craft of songwriting, is that you really wear your fame lightly and make yourself so accessible. When I took my first songwriting workshop with you, we've talked about this a few times, and the only reason I heard about it was my dad was dying, and that was the reason I came back to Texas, and I was making this trip two or three times a week from Wimberley to the north side of San Antonio, where he was, and it would usually be during a certain time of day, and I would have on KNBT, you know, my favorite radio stations in the whole world, from New Braunfels. And all of a sudden, this ad kept coming on about this songwriting workshop with Susan Gibson. You know, I'm like, who is Susan Gibson? You know, I don't. But I was hungry for anything. And when I signed up for this, of course, I do my research. Rodney knows I love to do research. But,
yeah, very thorough.
I know what hospital you were born in, Susan. so you won't get away with anything.
Yeah.
But that experience, I thought, okay, it'll be more about, you know, the inner artist and all this. But it was simply to this day, and I, as you know, I've been to some pretty awesome songwriting workshops, another one of yours included, but simply how you share the practicalities of, okay, so you need a bridge. Well, here are five ways to think about going into a bridge. I'm like, wow, there's a way you can think about this and honor the craft itself and the song itself. So your accessibility. Oh, I have to, Rodney, I haven't told you this story. At the end of this day, we all got to perform at the Brontex, which is where it was. And Susan is the first to know, and Andrew Harden is probably the second. I don't play the guitar. I play at it. I play around it. And I was happy to pour my song, but I asked Susan if she would play along with me. She's like, of course, you know. So there I am on the stage of the Brontex, and Susan Gibson is playing backup for me.
And it was a highlight of my career. Yeah. It really
certainly mine.
Yeah. I mean that. You know, it does not, like, I get inspired that from, you know, the big stars and the big famous and the, you know, the music that I love that feeds me. But you know what inspires me more is seeing someone that's not quite sure go try it. You know, I think that stems from, and I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm so sorry.
No.
I have to interject.
I can ramble.
Well, I have to say that, you know, when I was in Missoula, I ran an open mic, and I the only reason I was qualified to run an open mic was because I had a PA system. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know anything about anything, but I had the microphone and the speakers, and to see the people come in there and just, you know, excuse my language, but grab their balls and just go for it. That is what is exciting to me. Not someone that has perfected this thing. You know what I mean? Like, I want to see courage and guts and heart. And so when I get in a situation like the one you're talking about with, you know, playing on the Brontex, which is as big a stage as I've ever played, you know what I mean? Like, that's a big stage with big lights, big sound, dedicated sound man. You know, that's a big deal. And even though it wasn't a packed house or anything like that, like, there are things that would easily scare someone away from that. You know what I mean? And so when I get to be in the space with someone that is really, you know, doing exactly what the point of all of this is, which is sharing something vulnerable in a courageous way in order to connect with people, that's up. I will buy that ticket every single time. And if I get to play with that person, oh my God, it's very cool.
Hey, I know four chords.
So. Hey, let's
you only need three.
Yeah,
you only need three. Well, that song is probably, that time is probably the only time I've ever performed that song publicly because it is so emotional to me. And then when you said, oh yeah, that's a Lonesome Waltz, I was like, that's a Lonesome Waltz. So when I'm doing a song circle or something privately, I'll say, if you're gonna play along, it's a Lonesome Waltz, and I sound so knowledgeable.
Oh, I love it.
Well, let's talk about some of your other songs, because Wide Open Spaces obviously is kind of your calling card, and you won all kinds of awards for that. The CMA Single Songwriter of the Year, is that correct? And
that is correct.
Also BMA Writer of the Year. And I just also have to mention, because I did do my research, and I knew this, but I didn't know exactly what it meant. You were in 2009, you became a member of the West Texas Music Hall of Fame, and you were the Entertainer of the Year. So I went to go say, oh, what company is she in? Well, I ran out of space on my my little note card. But let's start with Guy Clark, Mac Davis, Vicky Carr, Kevin Fowler, Buddy Holly, J.D. Souther, who was probably in my top 10 all-time favorite performers, songwriters of all time. And the list goes on and on and on and on and on. Mm. So that is quite esteemed. They are in quite esteemed company.
Oh, I do believe it's the other way around.
But I want to talk a little bit about some of your songs and the songwriting process, because we're just talking about, well, one of the reasons we've all connected is through this fabulous Blue Rock Artist Ranch and Studio here in Wimberley, and Billy and Dodie Crockett and all the fabulous music that goes on there. And there have been several songwriter retreats, and you were... you were the leader, faculty, facilitator. Was that the year? Was it you and Billy and who else?
Jonathan Berg.
Oh, yes. Mm. We had him on our show, too. So,
We've had him all.
Well, now we have, now that we've had Susan. And one of the things, Rodney, in these retreats is we get song prompts. And at the time, because Deirdre and I were actually working the retreat, we weren't actually writing the songs, but we could listen to what people came up with the next day. And Susan gets up there and she starts to sing a song called The Diagnostic Heart.
Yeah.
Do you remember that and how that came about?
I do remember that. I remember mishearing
someone.
I was eavesdropping, because that is one of my songwriting strategies, is hear what other people are talking about. And I was listening to a conversation happen, and I thought I overheard the woman say, diagnostic heart, say the phrase, diagnostic heart. I didn't get the context. Anyway, I gave it as a song prompt, and I think people took it home, and that was kind of their homework project, to kind of write a verse or a verse and a chord, whatever they could come up with. And they astounded me when they brought their ideas back, and they were so different
And did you steal them all? And
you know what? I had a song to bring to the group the next day, and I don't know if it was finished. I don't know if it was finished, but I remember my favorite part of the writing process is when you get deep enough in where you cannot put it down. And that is, I remember going home that night from Blue Rock and sitting on my bed with Wikipedia open, getting all sorts of like medical language in front of me. And so I wrote this song that is, you know, kind of straight metaphor all the way through. And just with this cool language that plays different parts, you know, and I really love the song. It went on my last album.
Yeah, I know. I love the song. Yeah.
Thank you. But the best part of that was this reminder to me that I need this all the time. This is why I teach songwriting workshops, is because I need this stuff, is the idea that we both started like all of us, that, what were there, 20 people? Mm-hmm. 20 people mm-hmm. started with the same pair of words, and the ideas, it just supernova exploded into all of these beautiful things, you know?
Do you recall do you recall what the actual phrase was that you misheard?
I believe it was agnostic start. She was talking about like
I would have heard something else, but
yeah.
Wow. And out of that came all of those great songs. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that I love the song. I love the exercise. I loved hearing everyone's, you know, what they came up with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the nugget I took away from that is like, oh my God, mm-hmm. creativity is boundless and endless yeah. and plentiful. And, you know, there is no scarcity in creativity.
Yeah.
It's just it's antithetical.
I think about that. This reminds me of, you know, with photography, I can get 20 people, give them all the exact same camera, the exact same mm-hmm. settings, right. And you're going to get 20 yeah. completely yeah. different photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. That's amazing. Yeah.
There's another concert of yours that's special to me, and I know to a lot of people in this town, that I'd just like to talk about and hear your thoughts about. And that was a very special concert at Blue Rock after the flood of 2015. And I think that was, again, Billy and you and Kevin Welch. Is that correct? How did you approach that moment and holding that moment for yourself, as well as knowing you're holding it for a lot of other people at the same time? What was that process like for you?
Well, you mean with that Little Piece of Heaven song?
Yeah, the Little Piece of Heaven. Oh, just love that song.
You know, so, but in 2015, I had lived here for 12 years. I moved here in 2003. And there is a part of me that feels so at home here. But there's also a part of me that, you know, I traveled a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. I bet between, you know, I'll just say this. When COVID hit and we were all forced inside and to stay home, that was probably the first time I'd been home 10 days in a row since I moved here.
Yeah.
And so mm-hmm. there was a, you know, there's this kind of competing idea for if Wimberley is my home, or Wimberley is the road is my home and Wimberley is my retreat, you know? Mm-hmm. And when the flood happened, and you know, I'm the Blanco is right behind me. Mm-hmm. I had water in my yard,
mm-hmm.
but no damage to my property. I had a fence that kind of pulled away with the snags going through there. And I zip tied it shut. That was the extent of my mm-hmm. home repairs, was zip tying, you know, my fence back to the post. Shanghai. And so, you know, but when I saw how people, you know, responded to each other in those moments, and it was terrifying. I was out of town when the flood happened, so I was seeing on Facebook people's damage to their places and kind of wondering, you know, what? I could not imagine that I had water in my yard, because I'm that far from the river, and I'm also up a little bit from the river. So just seeing people say, we need diapers and bleach over here at the, you know, Methodist Church, and then, you know, 30 seconds later, I'm on it. I'm coming with diapers and bleach. And I lost our quilt, you know, my heirloom quilt from my grandmother. And, you know, the next day someone's like, we found your quilt. We're having it washed. We're, you know, I found a box of photographs, you know, or just the way people were. And when they said, how are you? It was not a greeting. It was an honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Spiritual question,
genuine,
you know,
concern,
and what do you need, and what do I have, what do you need, and I've got that, and here you go. And mm-hmm. I just thought, oh my God, if Wimberley's not my home, I sure want it to be, because just the you know, I say this sometimes when I introduce that song, you know, I'm kind of skeptical of people, but I've always trusted in nature, and that event flipped it upside down.
Yeah.
Well, like I was like, oh, Mother Nature, I don't know, you're kind of a bitch.
Yeah.
And excuse my language. And then I saw all these people, these mere mortals, you know, coming together and being divine for each other. And so that was the, and you know, again, everything that we said in those days and weeks after that was a prayer. It was please or thank you, you know, mm-hmm. and kind of reminds me of that, the Anne Lamott, help, thanks, wow. The only prayers you ever need, help, thanks, and wow.
Yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. And I just saw that in the community. So that song, as aching as it was to have that happen, the song was easy mm-hmm. to write. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was so it wrote itself, you know. Wow. Because, and the concert was so beautiful. Because, mm-hmm. you know, Billy and Dodie are, man, they are so quick to see a situation mm-hmm. like that and think, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And then their follow through is just insanely great. And so they do it. And then they really do affect people's lives, you know?
Yeah.
And it was so awesome to be a part of that when, you know, I thought, I don't know what to do for people. I don't know what to do for people. Mm-hmm. And they gave an outlet for that. So.
Yeah, it just comes so natural for them, for that
yeah.
kind of thing. Yeah, I don't even think they yes. think about it. It just...
Right.
Yeah.
To move it out from the individual to the community to the universal, almost.
They called our town a paradise, the jewel of the Blanco River. Postcards and t-shirts advertise a little piece of heaven. These trees have stood for centuries with their feet in the blue-green water. Witnesses to world wars and the christening of generations of sons and daughters. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. We built our homes out of the rock, and we've always prayed for rain. And a fragile flock withstand another drought again. And as the storm clouds gather and the dust turns into mud, we grab onto each other. It's the only way to survive the flood. Amen.
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 That whole story And that experience, I think, just permeates so much of your writing, but those are such a punctuation of your humanity when you write. And that leads directly, Rodney, into a particular episode or event. I can't even find the right words, dynamic, that we particularly want to talk with you about today. And it's a similar outcome to responding to a need, and that is the launch and the video and the website around this absolutely brilliant and beautiful song you've written called Compassionate Combat. And we'd love for you to walk us through that. How does something go from a seed or a prompt into a platform now that is touching so many people?
You know, boy, I have tried to dissect this, Chick. I have tried to look at this because it has had so much energy around it, and it's not been from me pushing it. It's been from it being pulled forward, but by the hands of people that have agreed to help me with it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you know, so that was a song. There's a organization called Songs for the Soul, and it's a nonprofit that my friend Carolyn Phillips runs. She's an oncology nurse and has done her doctorate studies in like compassion fatigue and caregiver fatigue, and how do we help nurses care for themselves, because they are the last ones to care for themselves because they're taking care of everyone else. So I have done a couple projects with her, and she has kind of an ongoing thing. So when COVID hit back in April, she, you know, put out a call to a bunch of songwriters that she's worked with all over the United States and invited us to write songs for our nurses. And I don't know if she gave everyone specific targets, but for me, she had a niece that was a nurse up in Nebraska. And there was a story, and I saw this story before I had talked to Carolyn, but there was a story of people who brought their RVs up to this nursing home in Nebraska, and because nurses couldn't come and go from their homes, right? Because we knew so little about it. So a bunch of people from the community had brought their RVs up to park outside of the nursing home to give these nurses place to go and sleep so that they weren't going back and forth between their homes and the nursing home. And her niece was one of those, and that story made a national mark, right? And so her niece was one of those nurses. And so I really started listening for stories about nurses. And, you know, then I heard another one about them taping pictures of themselves on their gowns so that there would be some, you know, glimpse of humanity there when they're all gowned, masked, goggled, you know, shield, you know, I mean, they were just doing everything they could to, you know, what is it the substitute for human connection, you know? Mm-hmm. And the nurses are trying to figure that out while dealing with an unprecedented pandemic and a disease that we don't know very much about. And they're trying to reassure and comfort people when they can't even touch them, you know, and try to make sure that the patients didn't feel like the nurses were afraid of the patients, because there was that. Like, I can't imagine, you know, you don't catch diabetes from taking care of a patient with diabetes, but with COVID, like, they're putting themselves in. So it was this accumulation of all these images and stories that I heard, and really just the enormous weight we have put on them, you know, and they're dealing with it, you know, at their own expense. You know what I mean? That because, you know, and Billy and I had so many conversations about this song. We we did a little Zoom chat that's on the website. So it's become this website. And mm-hmm. like you said, a platform to have this conversation, because I feel like there's a lot of conversation about the disease. And then we get these little blips of good news about a nurse or whatever, but, and that's great. That's really great. But to let the nurses have a little bit of a say and be part of that conversation, because their training is to suck it up and move on. You know what I mean? And, you know, that's hard enough in a normal thing where, you know, in an oncology situation where they'll take care of a patient for months and then lose them and have to detach. And so some of them, you know, their defense is to stay detached. And so they're human beings that have emotions, and, you know, and how do they deal with that? So now let's look at the situation that we're in right now, where they're losing, you know, they'll lose four patients before the end of their shift. You know what I mean? And granted, they didn't have them for months. And some of them they did have for months. So, you know, some people have been in those situations for a long time, and, you know, the holding up the iPad so that people can say goodbye to their families. I mean, we're just asking so much of these people who meet us on our worst days all the time. Like, we're always bringing our disasters to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it came together. And you know what? This song came together because I got to play a live one of Blue Rock's winter concert series gigs in November.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a tiny little risk and I played this new song. Mm-hmm. You were there. I was staring at your picture.
Oh, yeah.
I made eye contact.
That's right. That's right.
Your headshot.
Did you see the tears in my eyes?
I did. I thought I saw it. I thought I saw it. No, it's great. Yeah. But that was, you know, that was such a, I'll tell you, I think what made me think it was a good idea to do that song, number one, Blue Rock is the scene of a lot of my new songs getting outside of my living room for the first time, because we would do these Blue Tuesdays mm-hmm. where he would host songwriters and we'd go take our new stuff and we'd get feedback from other writers. And it was wonderful. It was, you know, most of the songs on my album that I put out in 2019 came from those sessions. Mm. Those writing sessions.
Oh, that's cool.
And yeah, I mean, it was such a big presence in mm-hmm. my writing for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I didn't even get to do, you know, I didn't even do it all the time. I did it while I was in town. And, but it really, that place and Billy, hold a mentor, major influence in my heart as a writer. Because of what he has facilitated for me and so many other writers to have that kind of contact. So I'm sitting there in Blue Rock and I'm playing to a beautiful room, great sound system. It was the first time I'd heard my voice through a sound system in a year, mm-hmm. you know, or 9 months or whatever that was. And so it just felt good. And I'm looking and I'm seeing these faces of all the people that are season ticket holders, and they've printed out, you know, all the faces, you know, mm-hmm. but for your listeners,
yeah.
Blue Rock printed out the faces of all the people that have, and if they bought a ticket, you know, whatever, and up on the walls. And so all the people, it was beautiful. And I thought Billy and Doty are doing that, taping the face on the ground. So there's a human contact there.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like
right.
that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And it just, so then, after the sound check, I thought, well, you know, it feels really terrible to come to Blue Rock and not have a new song to play. And so I backstage, while they were introducing the show and welcoming people to the show, I sat there and listened to the voice memo on my phone and jotted down the lyrics on the paper towel. So I could put them up on the stool.
That's a very Susan Gibson story. I love that.
It is. Total pro. I mean, it's a total pro move. But you know, again, like with the seed that I get to take away from that and plant hopefully over and over again, is like, I took a tiny little risk. Like, really, what was I risking? Maybe messing up a song. But Blue Rock's a great gig. You don't really want to mess it up at Blue Rock. You know, you want to do that on a Facebook Live somewhere video else. Or yeah.
Anywhere else.
Anywhere else. So anyway, Dr. Cole Edmondson, who is a friend of Blue Rock and Billy and a supporter of their concert series, he was listening and he got energy out of this song and really, he really was the one that, you know, he asked Billy, is there a recording of this song somewhere? I'd love to share it. And I'm like, well, I've got a voice memo on my phone, you know? And so then it became, Billy got involved in it and we, and Cole and AMN Healthcare is his company that he works with. I mean, it's a huge company. Mm-hmm. They're a nurses staffing organization. And so, you know, they're the ones that are putting nurses in the hot spots and you know, all these traveling nurses that are having to go where the need is. And now with vaccinations, happening everywhere, we need them as much now as we ever did. And so that's what they do. And so he and AMN funded the recording. And I think I got Billy at a bargain basement price. You know what I mean? He and the studio, we got to record in the studio and it just kind of began, and then we brought in Brent Talent to do a video for it. So there was a video to share and it just really got like pulled along by other people saying, I would love to help with that, you know? And it's really become this wonderful thing of, you know, of getting passed around. You know, I got to remember, you know, this was for nurses to hear, to have a little bit of, you know, I called it my COVID relief package. You know what I mean? It's mine only lasts for like 4 minutes. Five, if you take a minute afterwards to really sit in that gratitude. But you know, it again, like the Blue Rock concert at the for the flood, it was like, what can I do? Right. Well, this is what I know how to do. And then I got a tremendous amount of help from Billy and Dodie. And their whole team there at Blue Rock. I mean, Nathan was up there, you know, helping us. And Nathan Walters was up there helping us. And we had Walt Wilkins and Bill Small and Adam and Chris Carroll and Betty Sue and Elizabeth Wills and Josh Greider sing on the, you know, these beautiful.
And like, Deirdre, of course. Like,
and Deirdre, oh my God.
If you want instant soul, just bring Deirdre into the room.
Right.
That's it, man. She really kind of became a centerpiece of what the tone was going to be. We had, you know, we had way more conversations about the tone of gratitude we were trying to put out there than we ever did about what should the guitar do in this part.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You know, Susan.
And Deirdre encapsulates that.
Would it be okay with you if we played that song right now?
I would absolutely love it if you did.
You're used to giving. Did you hear a call or were you driven to service your whole life? Do you put yourself in danger? Do you risk it all to help a stranger? Well, the nurses don't think twice. We ask so much of you. Leave your families and your homes for the work you gotta do. You are the miracle, the gift, pulling 18-hour shifts of compassionate combat. How do you thank someone for that?
Susan, before we leave you completely, we want to be sure that folks know where to find this beautiful song.
Well, it's at a website that is compassionate, www.compassionatecombat.com. And that holds the song, the video. You can download it. You can share it. And then ultimately, I mean, and that's the goal. And then a byproduct of the goal to get it shared to anybody that might need to hear that, you know, and to be seen. We have a donate button on there that goes to the American Nursing Foundation. So they are, you know, they're an organization that's been around for 125 years, helping nurses with just all from kind of from beginning to end. They have scholarship foundations. They have, you know, making sure that the nurses have the latest information about the diseases that they're fighting and the technology. They have direct COVID disaster relief funds there. And so it felt like a really appropriate place if people feel like giving. But the song is free. The video is free. I would love for you to spread it far and wide.
Susan, it's always a pleasure and it's so much fun, but it's always so meaningful to have a conversation with you. And our guest today has been Susan Gibson, who is a internationally known singer, songwriter, a songwriter mentor and coach. And I'm proud to say she's been my mentor and coach. And for
she made the chicks famous.
Well, and she's working on another one, aren't you, Susan? Another chick, right?
That's right, man.
And for me and Rodney, she's also a neighbor, and we're proud to call her a friend. So we want to thank you for this beautiful time together and can't wait to share it with all of our listeners. And we also want to thank Rupert Neve Design for our wonderful equipment. And this is where Rodney and I just kind of give a little nod, a little bow of the head to beautiful Rupert Neve and all he's meant to the world of music and to audio. And again, another neighbor, another Wimberley neighbor. Mm-hmm. And we are so fortunate to be operating with Rupert Neve Design Equipment. We want to thank Donathan Frankenreiter for our bouncy and wonderful intro and outro music. And we also want to thank the fabulous Brock Glenn Thomas, who is our producer and editor and always makes us sound better than we are and should be. So we want to thank you again for tuning in and listening to Passports, Please. And we look forward to speaking with you again.
You're used to giving. Did you hear a call, or were you driven to service your whole life? Do you put yourself in danger? Do you risk it all to help a stranger? Well, the nurses don't think twice. And we ask so much of you. Leave your families and your homes for the work you gotta do. You are the miracle, the gift, pulling 18-hour shifts of compassionate combat. How do you thank someone for that? You get to your task. An angel in a homemade mask. You got your picture taped on your gown. Machines for ventilation. Human beings need more than medication. And there's no sign of slowing down. And we ask too much of you. You are a marvelous machine. You got your bedside manners too. You are the miracle, the gift, pulling 20-hour shifts of compassionate combat. How do you thank someone for that? And out there on the front lines, can you feel that we're behind you? We'll take every we can, just to remind you that we see you, and we love you, and we need you, so thank you. And we're gonna ask too much of you. Hold our hands as we let go, or hang on and pull us through. You are the miracle, the gift, in every single shift of compassionate combat. And you can thank a nurse for that.